Welcome back to The Source. I'm Paul Flav, in for David Martin Davies. Our next topic deals with history. It's a history of what happens right after you hear this sound. We're talking about the history and the future of bringing the dead back and the methods of resuscitation that can do it. It's explored in a new book, Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Deceased, the Recently Dead. Dr. David Casaret is the book's author. He joins us over the phone. Dr. Casaret, welcome to The Source.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And listeners, if you have a story of being brought back from the other side, trying to use CPR, whether it succeeded or failed, give us a call. Or if you've been following the research on where we're going and are excited, want to ask an expert on it, 210-614-8980 is the number to call. Or email us at thesource@tpr.org. Now, Dr. Casaret, people have been interested in extending life for probably as long as they've been, since they realized that they were actually going to die. But you start your story. You delve into the history and the efforts, and it looks like it starts in Amsterdam in a real meaningful way. So tell us about the Society in Favor of Drowned Persons, which is an excellent name.
It's interesting. People have been interested in bringing back the dead for a very, very long time, even as far back as ancient times. But it really got some science underneath it in the late part of the 18th century, in the 1700s. As you say, first in Amsterdam, and not too long after, actually, in England. In both countries, a group of concerned citizens got together and created societies, basically public organizations, that were devoted not just to trying to revive the dead, but to figure out what works. And we know a lot about what those societies did in Amsterdam and London because they kept copious notes. They would try all manner of things, and then they would make notes of what worked and what didn't. And a lot of what we do today has been influenced by their accounts of things that were successful and things that were not so successful.
So give us some of the highlights.
Well, there were a lot of very, very interesting things that were tried. Sometimes it's easier to come up with a list of things that weren't tried because you go down the list and you think, is there anything you guys didn't think of? One of my favorites, my personal favorites, is throwing a cardiac arrest victim over the back of a horse and encouraging that horse to trot. I actually tried that, I'm embarrassed to admit, in researching the book because I wanted to get a sense of what it would be like. And also to get a sense of how it might work. And I confess, I really have no idea. I guess you could imagine that it might replicate some of what happens during CPR, might help to breathe for the person. But I can tell you from personal experience, it's very uncomfortable, and I would not recommend it.
So that was one of their failures. But you said they did have some successes. I think you pointed out maybe they had kept some pretty good notes, and they claimed 150 saves. So, do you believe that number is correct? And what did we actually see come out of the Society for Drowned Persons?
Well, unfortunately, it's really hard to tell whether those were true saves or not. They didn't have a lot of technology back then. They didn't even have stethoscopes, at least in general use. They certainly didn't have cardiac monitors. So if a group of concerned citizens came across somebody lying in the street, they poked and prodded that person and the person woke up, that could be counted as a save. Did that person actually have a cardiac arrest, or was he just taking a nap? It's tough to tell. Having said that, though, some of the things that they did are still in use now. The Dutch were actually some of the original inventors of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. That's part of CPR protocols. Something else that was used a lot was something that was known somewhat ominously as the Russian method, which consisted of taking cardiac arrest victims, drowning victims, and burying them in snow. We don't actually do that to patients nowadays, but we do cool them. So patients who have a cardiac arrest often benefit from what are called hypothermia protocols that decrease their temperature and in the process decrease their metabolism, and means they use less oxygen and they can survive longer without a heartbeat. So we've gained some tricks from things that they were trying way back then.
We're talking to David Casaret. He's a palliative care specialist and associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Their Perelman School of Medicine, his book, Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. I'm glad you brought up cold, because you Your book has several references to the importance of low temperature, and so much so that one reviewer commented it should be called chilled instead of shocked. So I was just wondering, when did medicine realize the importance of slowing down the metabolism through making people cold?
Well, even back in the 18th century, there were hints that people were using cold, although whether they knew what it was actually doing, I think, is up for grabs. A lot of the interest actually came from the 1950s in Europe. One person that's responsible for a lot of this is an Irish physician named John Wary Dundee, who in the 1950s developed surgical protocols that involved some drugs that were designed to prevent people from shivering, to increase their own temperature, but also involved ice, often lots and lots of ice. And he, in an article that was published back in the 50s, reports his experience with 26 patients who he took through surgery trying to reduce their temperature and hopefully improve their surgical outcomes. It's hard to tell how well he did. He reports that only 5 of those 26 patients died, which doesn't seem like great odds today, but back then it wasn't bad. But even back then, there was this suspicion that if we could reduce somebody's metabolism, if we could reduce their oxygen requirements, we could put them in a better position to withstand either a cardiac arrest or a drowning or some of the challenges that come with surgery, like extremely low blood pressures.
Now, you mention a lot of experiments in the book. You mention a lot of things that people tried, but the ones that really pushed the boundaries of what people thought, it seemed to me in reading your book, were the accidents. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about Anna Johansson, for instance, and how her experience really pushed the level of what doctors thought was possible.
Yeah, there have been several high-profile media stories. One that you mentioned is Anna Bogenholm, who was, was a physician, actually, who was in an accident, found herself trapped under the ice in Norway in a stream for about 80 minutes. Despite the fact when she was finally removed, she was not breathing, she didn't have a heartbeat, and her body temperature was 13 degrees, much, much lower than the normal temperature of 38 degrees. So people looked at stories like that and began to ask themselves, well, why is it that this woman could survive such a prolonged period underwater? What was her secret? And that's what led many people to learn from accidents like this. And one of the lessons from hers, as well as other accidents that I described in the book, was the benefits of cold temperatures.
David Casaret is a doctor and professor at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book, Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, is out now. We want to hear from you. Do you have questions about where the Reviving the Dead could be going? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Paul Flab. We are listening to KSTX. Welcome back to The Source. I'm Paul Flav in for David Martin Davies. We're talking about Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, the new book out from Dr. David Casaret, associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, talking about the history and the future of resuscitation. We've talked a little bit about the history. Let's get to the future. Dr. Casaret, what are the things that you've seen that are really exciting to you that you think really will be the future of potentially resuscitation?
Well, sure. You promise you won't laugh?
I don't, actually. Sorry about that.
I tell people one of the biggest surprises to me was the role that suspended animation might play. And I tell them that, and in general, their first response is, oh, that's what happens on science fiction. And indeed, it's pretty hard to watch a science fiction film these days without seeing some reference to suspended animation. Usually to get from one side of the galaxy to another. But there's a lot of neat stuff going on in the field of suspended animation, although respectable researchers don't like to have it referred to that way.
What are the code words they're using to describe it? so that media folks like myself don't say, oh, suspended animation.
So I'm probably shouldn't be giving away these secrets, but as a media tip, I will tell you that, one of the words that's used a lot is hypometabolism, which is really what suspended animation is. It's a way of tricking the body into a lower metabolism. It's a way of tricking the body into a lower gear so that it uses less oxygen. Other people use have used for decades, actually, the term artificial hibernation. And that's actually an interesting term because that's essentially what researchers are trying to do. They're trying to figure out what the secret of hibernation is. How do animals as varied as squirrels and marmots and bears and even one bird species, how do they enter a state of hibernation? And what sorts of tricks could we steal from them to help a patient, say, who's experienced a cardiac arrest, enter a state of hibernation?
This is different than, obviously, what we were talking about before with doing it through cooling the body and getting the metabolism lower through temperature.
Right, exactly. Although, to be fair, it's the same principle. The idea is that if you reduce somebody's oxygen requirement, they can live longer and survive in better shape without oxygen. But yes, it's different. You can almost think of cold as kind of a cheap and easy way to induce a state that's kind of like hibernation. But I think the researchers who are really going full steam ahead into this area are thinking about using some combination of naturally occurring molecules or hormones that trick the body into a state of suspended animation.
And what successes have they had? Have they been able to transfer from one animal that naturally does it to an animal that does not?
No, or if we have, I have not managed to figure that out. Some of the earlier experiences actually in squirrels, and I go into these experiments in a lot of detail in the book, involved figuring out what chemicals, what molecules occur in a hibernating squirrel, and then transferring in the form of a transfusion those molecules into another squirrel and inducing hibernation. That was one of the first clues way back in the 50s that there might be some compound, some molecule in a hibernating squirrel's blood that causes hibernation and then could also cue hibernation in an animal. As far as we know, though, or at least as far as I know, animals, or in the case of people, are either hardwired to hibernate or not. And humans, unfortunately, don't.
Now, I want to go back to what you said earlier, talking about trying to maybe hide the more cynical things that could be used to be said about something, about research specifically is what I'm trying to say. And I wanted you point out one of the instances this happened in a research project. It got an unfortunate label, and it was never able to shake that label, and forever and always it really kind of derailed the research. And I'm talking specifically about zombie dogs.
I was afraid the zombie dogs would come up in this conversation.
So tell us, I mean, what was the research and what did it do? I mean, what did this unfortunate label really do to this researcher?
Well, to be fair, I'm not sure the label slowed the research down in the end. It was certainly uncomfortable. And for your listeners, what happened? This was some really, I think, fascinating, exciting, and very, very important research that came out of the University of Pittsburgh about 10 years ago. I'm oversimplifying a lot. I provide a lot more detail in the book. But basically what the researchers did was to show that by cooling the bodies and brains of dogs who had had a cardiac arrest a long way, much more than we would usually do in the setting of a cardiac arrest in a person, that they could dramatically improve the outcomes of those dogs even after periods of several hours of not having a heartbeat. They were still able to bring these dogs back to life. And I should be clear, that those experiments were amazing. They're one of the most exciting things to happen in resuscitation research that I came across in the last 50 years. Unfortunately, because Night of the Living Dead was filmed in Pittsburgh, where these experiments were conducted, the media latched on to that unfortunate coincidence, that plus the fact that they were bringing dogs back from the dead, labeled these experiments zombie dog experiments, which got them a lot of both negative publicity, but also more humorous publicity, which, as a researcher, you really, really don't want.
And the university doesn't really like talking about it anymore.
Well, they certainly weren't enthusiastic about talking to me,
right,
for obvious reasons. I think if you're doing legitimate science and the media is either not taking you seriously or is making fun of you, makes you think twice about talking to anybody, even if it's somebody like me who's a legitimate researcher in his own right with a pedigree at an Ivy League medical school. They've been burned many times, and I think they were leery. I should be clear, though, that there is actually a clinical trial going on now, also at the Safra Center, that is a direct outgrowth of these experiments, which now promises to help a lot of people by cooling them down to about 50 degrees. So that's also very exciting. And research kept going despite that zombie dog label, but it was unfortunate.
210-614-8980 is our number if you'd like to get a question into Dr. David Cassaret about his new book, Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. So I'm really interested in how this book relates to your work, your day job, which is as a professor and also working in palliative care, because you say in the book that, you know, in the case of Michelle Funk, this young girl who died of drowning and was revived, resuscitated after 3 hours, that inspired you to become a doctor. And then you went into a field that actually helps you help people analyze their managing pain as well as ending their treatment, or if that's what they choose to do. It gives them some more perspective on life. And I'm just wondering what happened to kind of change from being this ER guy who is shocking people back to life to someone who is helping people map out the harsh realities of treatment.
Sure. I find that all the big changes in my career and, you know, in other colleagues' careers too, happen because of patients we've taken care of, and I'm no different. If Michelle Funk's story, this remarkable story of somebody who survived after 3 hours with no heartbeat, made me want to become an emergency room doc. Then there was another patient I met when I was in medical school. I tell this story in more detail in the book about a guy who I helped to bring back from the dead as a medical student, only to see him spend 18 days in an intensive care unit, unable to wake up, unable to breathe on his own. To the last day, he couldn't even recognize his friends or family. And that made me think about whether and when bringing people back from the dead really is the right thing to do. And so it's those two factors that have guided me, the fact that we could often do a lot to help people, but we need to do a much better job at helping patients and families to think through whether that's really what they want and whether that's what's best for them.
So often when I talk to medical professionals, you know, they do have that question of when they have, you know, resuscitated someone, they're returning them back to, you know, the state they were in before they left, which may not have been a great state in the first place. So it isn't like when we talk about this subject, it's obviously not one that's a cure-all. We're not talking about a cure-all. We're talking about bringing people back to the state they were originally in, if not a little worse. And I know that was a comment we got from in our email, so I wanted to make sure we pointed that out. And something not lost on a palliative care guy.
Sure. I mean, to bring people back to the state that they were at before the cardiac arrest, if people are lucky, and often they're not lucky, and they come back in a state that is sometimes considerably worse. You know, we think of stories like Anna Bogenholm or Michelle Funk, who make these amazing recoveries, but life is much more messy than that. We're good at people bringing people back from the dead. We're much less good, often, at curing the illnesses that led to that cardiac arrest in the first place. I use the story in the book of the mythologic figure Tithonus, who, the story goes, asked Zeus for immortality, but forgot to ask for eternal youth. And so he gradually got older and sicker and more frail. He couldn't die, but was never healthy again. And it does feel, as a doctor, sometimes that's what we're helping people to do. We're helping them to live longer, but not necessarily better.
Now, I've only got about 50 seconds left before we say goodbye, but I was interested in this in the cases of you brought up, in Anna's case and in Michelle Funk's case. Does that actually make your other job as palliative care guy more difficult? Do people see these what could be described as miraculous cases and think, well, if I just leave my loved one on a little bit longer?
They do all the time, both patients and family members. And those sorts of stories make my job more difficult. But my job really isn't to talk people out of aggressive treatment. My job is to help them make the right decision for them. And so sometimes having those stories, and that gives them something to latch on to and gives them a way to explain to me what's important to them. And it's at least a conversation starter.
Dr. David Kasaret, thanks so much for joining us on The Source. His new book, Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, is out now.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.